Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 28, 2019. This is class 11 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk is on the Cittavagga, the third chapter from the Dhammapada, and it teaches the importance of a well-restrained mind. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So today is the 11th class of 32 of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into the three marks of existence. The three marks of existence describe the common human condition. This talk is from the third chapter of the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is a 26th chapter book in the Kudaka Nikaya, the fifth book of the Sutta Pitaka. A lot of new, strange words for some of you. It's simply the book that has preserved the teachings of the Buddha. And even that story is remarkable, but it's on the website. Description of how the Pali Canon came to be and how we can rely on it as the actual teachings of the Buddha. There's some speculation as to why the Dhammapada was collected in the way it was and organized the way it was. And if you read it, and I have all 26 chapters on the website, and there's talks associated with each chapter. If you read the Dhammapada, you can see how it builds from a basic direction to the culmination of the Buddha's path. And it's a remarkable book in its conciseness and the incredible amount of knowledge that's included in these 26 short chapters. Scholars tend to agree that it was put together as an instruction manual for novices, but I think it's much more than that. Every time I read it, I get some new wisdom out of it. It's a remarkable book. This is a third chapter called the Cittavagga. Citta, C-I-T-A, means the mind. Vagga has quite a few different translations, but in this context, it means teaching or understanding. And so we're understanding the mind, but even this is, it's important to understand the context. We're understanding the mind in relation to the Buddha's Dhamma and how to apply that. And you'll see how this relates directly to what we're studying, which is understanding ignorant views of self, wrong views, and from that understanding, pointing the mind towards directing a profound understanding of what it means to be a human being in an ever-changing environment. The mind, fickle, unsteady, difficult to restrain. Even so, the wise Dhamma practitioner straightens the mind like a skilled fletcher straightens an arrow. Immediately, the Buddha's telling us what to do. Straighten the mind. Straighten. Look at the visual. Straighten the mind like a fletcher straightens an arrow. It's something that the Buddha uttered 2,600 years ago, and we all still understand it today, don't we? Whether we're archers or not, we know what that means. A mind ruled by Mara is agitated, like a fish out of water, grasping and flopping here and there. Mara is a common metaphor used by the Buddha, and it's prevalent throughout the Sutta Pitaka. Most translations see Mara as some kind of disincarnate being that's actually acting on the Buddha and acting on everyone and continuing to this day. When you understand the Buddha's teachings on speculation and to not to go into speculation or non-physical establishments of views, you realize that Mara is simply a useful metaphor for a troubled mind, a mind rooted in ignorance. And that's all the Buddha ever meant to describe by Mara. But he's using Mara as something, as a malevolent god that is rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads. So he was using a common term of the time, just like he used karma and anatta and everything else, common terms, but in a very uncommon way. And the reason to do that, it would be almost impossible to teach a Dhamma by creating new words that people were unfamiliar with. You hear me say often the way, especially in our teacher training, we need to learn, whether it's teaching the Dhamma or just living in the world, to meet people where they are. And that's what that means. And sometimes metaphor is a good way of describing a person's quality of mind so we understand it.
But in a lot of the older religions, these deities often just stand for concepts.
Exactly.
And it was their way of wrapping their head around abstract concepts,
yes,
attributed to a god, meaning that they were part of that concept.
Yeah, and they're just describing an abstract quality of mind that may or may not be present in our human life, in our being. And so from that, using an abstract to define something practical, people that wanted a magical and mystical dharma, not just Buddhist dharma, but anything, would grasp on those kind of things because they fit their point of view. And rather than understanding the overarching context, which would show plainly that the Buddha is not talking about an actual non-physical being, but an abstract quality of mind, it's very convenient to say, well, there's all these gods and devas, and even things like Avalokiteshvara, who is the Hindu god of, I don't want to get too deep into it, the Hindu god of compassion and helpfulness, that has been incorporated in all of modern Buddhism as something the Buddha taught. The Buddha never uttered the word. But because it was an accepted description of a non-physical being and a quality that we would like to develop, we established the abstract rather than the practical. And again, that's the reason. So the use of metaphor is common, but it's not to be taken as there's an actual being, Mara. A mind ruled by Mara is agitated like a fish out of water, grasping and flopping here and there. It's a perfect metaphor. The mind is difficult to restrain, ever-changing, always clinging to objects of desire. The highest knowledge is restraint. Nothing magical, nothing mystical, not having a personal relationship with Mara or any other diva. The highest knowledge is the knowledge of restraint. Think about that. What an incredibly powerful statement, and I would say an incredibly courageous statement, because a mind rooted in ignorance is always needing more. It's always grasping. The last thing this mind wants is to hear that it has to restrain itself. And of course, it can't. It needs to just simply abandon the views that are preventing it from restraining itself. And that's what the Dhamma is about. Okay. The highest knowledge is restraint. A restrained mind dwells in peace, how the Buddha described the quality of an awakened human being. A grasping mind is subtle, hard to recognize. The wise restrain the mind. A well-restrained mind brings lasting happiness. Dwelling in distraction, the mind, disjoined from the body, wanders aimlessly. When subdued, the mind is freed from the bonds of Mara, the bonds of ignorance. Excuse me. Wisdom is never developed in a mind that is ignorant of the heart. When the Buddha, using the word heartwood, he simply means the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the heartwood of the Dhamma. Listless, not established in jhana. All direction on what we need to do if we're going to restrain the mind. That is the reason why the Buddha taught jhana meditation and not some other type of visualization practice or an escape type of practice, meaning using meditation to develop a trance-like state. It's not about that. It's meditation is to deepen concentration so that we can do just this. Learn and understand the higher knowledge of restraint. This just makes sense, doesn't it? How can a mind that is not well concentrated ever hope to practice restraint? And the meditation method that we use, you might want to talk about this, you may not. The meditation method that we use, being mindful of thoughts and feelings distracting us, arising and passing away, and coming back to our breath, is both metaphor and the practical explanation, the practical direction on what we're doing, deepening concentration. In that moment, when I'm sitting in meditation, and I realize I'm thinking about the Ferrari I'm picking up tomorrow, I'm not. I realize I'm distracted. I'm distracted by grasping after something. I don't need to analyze it. I don't have to get into why am I thinking about that? Why did I ever spend all that money on the blah, blah, blah? I come back to the breath. And in that moment, I'm practicing restraint. I'm practicing in that moment. I'm practicing the highest knowledge. Think about it. And as we continue our practice and integrate the entire Eightfold Path, it becomes a synergistic practice where the concentration developed, the jhana developed in the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path supports the other seven factors, and the other seven factors now support ever-deepening concentration. All leading to that single point, what we're doing. We're learning how to restrain the mind. And we're developing the framework for how to restrain that. This is something that we read, I think it was 2 weeks ago, here on the Bhava Sutta. You'll remember it. When the Buddha is describing karma. Where there is desire, there is fear. There is no fear in an awakened one, free of greed, aversion, and free of gaining and losing. Those are all aspects that arise out of ignorance of the three marks of existence. The wise understand the impermanence of form while fortifying the mind to abandon Mara. Again, clear direction. If we're going to abandon magical, mystical, fabricated views, I have to find a way to fortify the mind. And again, how do we fortify the mind? Through the Eightfold Path, through the heart width of the Dhamma. The Buddha points to that immediately. Established in right view, Mara is conquered, now free of worldly entanglements. So even the powers, the imagined powers we might give to something like that, we realize it is just a fabrication. We conquer it through our mind, not through merit, not through appeasing gods or appealing to gods. We do it by restraining our mind. In no time, the body is dust, mindless, lifeless, a useless stump. An unrestrained mind brings greater harm than any enemy or hater. What an incredibly powerful line. And if we look at all the difficulties we've had as human beings, as a society, and as individuals, it's because we don't know how to restrain our minds. And I don't watch a lot of news. I restrain myself to watching news to about an hour a week. I do read. I get, like many people too, I get compilations of news clips and I read, you know, what's interesting to me. But when you just watch the news for an hour and you can see it's just a perfect example of minds that are completely unrestrained and continuing to grasp after that level of lack of restraint. And attach everything continually to this unrestrained mind as a point of view. And many people do it in such a subtle way they don't realize what they're doing to themselves. They're building fabrication on fabrication to the point that we have hundreds of thousands of people running around in rage, but they're enraged by their own view that they fabricated in their own mind. And you've heard me say this often, we talk about it often here. The difficulties in the world, when we spend too much time focused on what's wrong, seem like it's as bad as it's ever been. In fact, it's not. It maybe is not any better than it's ever been, but it's exactly the same. And the problem is the same. The problem is a lack of restraint. Problem is a lack of restraint. And I'm certainly not talking about one person. I'm talking about everyone.
John, could the word control and restraint be interchanged in this context?
Yep, same thing. Control your mind. And again, that word control or restraint is not something a self-referential ego personality wants, does it? Mm-hmm. We don't want to hear it. I know I don't, especially up until I understood the value of restraint. In fact, you could say I lived the first 26 years of my life insisting that I not be restrained by anything. Needless to say, I wasn't the most pleasant child to bring up because it started at an early age. And because I lived my life insisting that I have no restraints placed on me, by the time I was 26 years old, I was near death. The effects of drugs and alcohol and other things that I was doing. But it all was because I insisted on not being restrained. And, you know, I work with a lot of people in recovery And so I see that rather extreme example and extreme experience of a lack of restraint. But that's all that it is. It's the same lack of restraint that I applied in overcoming addictions is the same restraint that I'm applying right now to maintain a calm and peaceful mind. It's all the same. I don't want to go too deep into that.
But in that time, your restraint was not fed by meditation.
Initially, it wasn't. But very quickly, I don't know how many people of you understand the 12 steps, and I won't explain it, but the 11th step that we take in a 12-step program, it's not done today at all, hardly, but the 11th step is to develop a meditation practice. And so very quickly in my recovery, the person that guided me through this 12 steps said, one of the most important things you can do now is to learn everything you can about meditation. This was back in 1981, and people don't say that today. Meditation is mostly overlooked in the 12-step programs. And so that's what started me. So to get to your point, very quickly I started using a form of meditation to begin to practice just the little bit of restraint I needed to establish sobriety. But of course, that's what laid the foundation for everything else. There's an initial restraint. Whether you're an addict or not, we're all addicted to our thoughts. We're all addicted to the world. That's part of the three marks of existence. So the restraint is the same.
John, I've always had issues with restraint and the transition, or aren't you abandoning wrong view? So why restraint? Like, to me, restraint is a willpower. Until you develop the deep concentration necessary, that you're really practicing some form of catching yourself, restraint. But don't you develop and then you start abandoning wrong view, and therefore is it still restraint?
Yes, boy, you're pointing me to it in most important point of the sutta. Excuse me. You're describing the process, the very subtle process, is at the point of contact. Excuse me. The Dhamma is practiced at the point of contact. That's where we practice restraint, and it's the only place we can. Is as my inner world encounters the outer world, and however that might be, whether it's an object, event, a view, an idea, objects include people. As I'm reacting to what I'm coming in contact with, what's coming in contact with my senses, if my mind is still rooted in ignorance and I'm still grasping after experience, I'm going to simply continue my ignorance. But in this moment, as I'm interfacing with impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, as I'm interfacing with phenomena arising and passing away, and I can recognize and practice restraint in this moment, recognizing that I'm continuing eye-making, then at that point, I can abandon the underlying ignorant view. And the abandonment can be direct, or it can be so subtle that we don't notice that we've done it. And I would bet for most of you, it's really the latter. We simply realize that our minds are more at peace. We realize that we're simply not grasping after things as compulsively and tenaciously as we were in the past. We mind still. In fact, most of us, it is this gradual process. But it's that ongoing process of restraint at the point of contact that leads to the abandonment.
And it's almost instantaneous once that happens.
It can be. It really can be. I'm loath to apply psychological explanations because we can get lost in them. But really what we're doing is retraining the mind. And it kind of depends on how each individual is clinging to their views, and everyone is different. And everyone's going through a different process to this point. The first, the Buddha's very first teaching, when he first taught the Four Noble Truths, he finished his very brief sutta, and one of his friends that had been studying with the Buddha for the previous 6 years understood completely. He got the Dhamma on that very first teaching. because he had already gone through the process of restraint and abandonment. And then there's the Buddha's cousin, who it took the Buddha's cousin 45 years and 1 month after the Buddha's passing to awaken. Did I address your question in your comment?
Yes.
Okay. And so it is just that where there's a definite willfulness to developing the Dhamma. Again, the reason why that's important is most, and this the Buddha didn't teach religion. Religions are almost exclusively taught as something that happens to us. The benefits of religion happen to us because I have belief, because I have faith. The Buddha realized how cruel that was in developing an understanding that the Dhamma is only developed through my own sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, through my own right efforts. That's all. And so this is a direct teaching on how to develop the Dhamma. Great question, David. Thank you. Let me go back one. An unrestrained mind brings greater harm than any enemy or hater. No one and no thing brings greater benefit than a mind well restrained. Read that once more for emphasis. No one and no thing brings greater benefit than a mind well restrained. A wonderful short sutta, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Nothing brings greater benefit than a mind well restrained. And so how do we restrain a mind? Beginning with jhana meditation, and as we develop it, we integrate the Eightfold Path. And it's just that. It's just that thing, that Eightfold Path. There's nothing outside of the Eightfold Path that we integrate except all the other teachings and the things that we do here in the different suttas all point to and support developing the Eightfold Path. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. It's such an important discussion, especially in this political climate.
Practice restraint, yeah.
I'm not sure I'm in love with the word restraint, though, because it's sort of like a pulling and a grabbing, and manipulating, and I kind of like rather look at it as, okay, you got this thought, release it, go back to the breath, more gently. Why do you think he used words that weren't so gentle?
Well, it's a translated word, too, so... I actually think it's the right word because it is what we're doing. We don't like it. A self-referential ego person like does not like the word restraint because it sounds like it's affecting me, meaning my ego personality. I'm losing something. But when you think about what we're doing at that point of contact, that's the right word. We are practicing restraint. And another word for release would be the abandonment. And so there first has to be restraint before we can release what there is. Or we won't notice it. Do you understand?
Yeah, abandonment sort of softens it again.
Yeah.
And sometimes I guess you do have to get in there and fight with yourself a little bit to maintain control.
Yes, and that's the restraint. And it's self-restraint too, by the way. This isn't a restraint that's being imposed on us by a religious philosophy or abstraction. It's up to us if we want to practice restraint. We don't have to. Of course, we can't develop
the out of control.
Yeah, but that's, excuse me, that's the choice every human being has to make, whether you're a Dhamma practitioner or not. At some point, you either learn restraint the hard way, meaning trial and error and suffering the benefits of it, or you don't. And again, whether you're a Dhamma practitioner or not, if you don't, you're going to suffer for it.
And you won't know you're not. Anyway, you won't know that you're not practicing restraint because you're unrestrained.
You're unrestrained, and you'll simply blame bad luck or the world or your spouse. You'll find something to blame for it. Hardly ever yourself, or even if you do blame yourself, it'll be in such a hurtful way, in such a hateful way that there's no benefit in that way of taking responsibility. This is the Buddha taught the ultimate responsibility for human beings. And it's also incredibly gentle when we understand it. So, you brought up a good point. People don't like, nobody likes to hear that word restraint until you develop the Dhamma. And now I kind of look for it. You know, where do I need to restrain myself? Yeah. Is there anything that I'm grasping after in this moment? Grasping after is a lack of restraint, isn't it?
Yeah.
Once you see the harm done by an unrestrained mind, then restraint becomes a really good thing.
Yeah.
As you said right here, it's the greatest enemy to your life. An unrestrained mind keeps you pulled into directions where you come to harm.
That's right. And always. I mean, you want to look at the difficulties that we've all gotten into in our lives. It was at some part of it was because of a lack of restraint.
There's also steps to the process, right? Because you can have a situation where you're not able to control your mind, but you can restrain your actions.
Yes, that's almost a preliminary aspect of this. You know, there's that middle part of the Eightfold Path, right? Speech, right action, and right livelihood. All of those are encountered with restraint, aren't they? With right speech is an aspect of restraint.
Right, you're restraining wrong speech.
Yep, and so is right action, and so is right livelihood. And so we need a framework to recognize even that. What is wrong speech? Most people would not notice that idle chatter and gossip is wrong speech simply because we do it so often. And it's so familiar, it's so common. How could I change that? Why would I even think of changing it? That's how we communicate. Guess what? It isn't. It's hurtful. When I teach young kids, especially teenagers, that's how I introduce the Dhamma to young children. And I ask them a simple question. I says, when you and your friend are getting together and you're talking about another friend that's not there, and maybe you're laughing at him a little bit, do you feel good? And inevitably, the kid will think a little bit and say, no, you know what? I don't feel good about that. And I said, well, why don't you just stop doing it? And they get it. They understand that. They understand it's their direct action. It's not because their friend deserves ridicule. They see that it's what's affecting the way they feel. And many, many people who take to the Dhamma, right speech is the first thing that they start developing because they see it there. It's so immediate. Mm. But that's what we're doing. We're practicing restraint. Julie, did you have your hand up?
I did.
Oh, okay.
It's just interesting because as the Buddha describes the world and as we go back to the governing principles, you know, the world is there, and Buddha's often described it as the world is a flame, it's on fire. Yep. So you need restraint to not get burned, because as the sutta is describing the subtleties of name and form at the point of contact, it takes a calm mind to see that, to practice that, and the calm mind is reflected through restraint. You know, that's what the embodiment is. So it takes restraint to not get burned, to not see these subtle attachments, and that's really what's being described there. So
That's right.
Restraint is the right word.
It is. Michael.
Could we look at restraint as the pause and the arrow that points us towards the Eightfold Path?
Sure. Yeah, that's because that's what it is in that moment, you know. Julia.
And until our mindfulness is refined, there's a process until it becomes a natural act.
Yep. Right. And that's just what we're doing here. We're all in different stages of that process. That's what the Dhamma is. It's a curriculum that defines that process. And it's very clear and direct. There's nothing ambiguous about this, is there? The you understand what it is, is the reason why it's difficult. But that's the only reason it's difficult. Julia.
I have a problem with the word restraint also.
See? Yeah, I was right. I started by saying that, didn't I?
I think maybe I'm more of a free type of person, like free spirit. I don't really like those type of words either, but I look at maybe what he's trying to, maybe what the Buddha is saying is it's a disciplined mind. It's a disciplined mind.
Yeah.
It's a mind trained. It's a mind cult. You know, you're cultivating your mind to like eliminate the weeds. You know, in this field, and so it's more of more like discipline instead of using that harsh word of restrain. It sounds like, you know, something like being.
The word restraint is not a harsh word. It's a harsh word because we don't like it. And so
right.
Even more so, I think that it's important to use the word because of that, and look at the reaction that it. Again, that's how I started this. is look at the reaction that we all have to that word. But where's the reaction coming from? It's coming from, I don't want to restrain myself.
John?
Yes.
I always like to roll back or forward to the example of the Buddha. And I asked you this once. I said, well, did the Buddha practice restraint at his final enlightenment? And I don't know if that's a proper, he's not practicing restraint. He's abandoned it. So he has a disciplined mind that restraint is no longer necessary.
Oh, yeah. At some point, it isn't. But it is necessary to get to that point. You read in the Gara Sutta, the Buddha practiced restraint. He describes it very well there. And even in the, I can't think of the word, Aditya Pariyaya Sutta, where the Buddha describes his noble search. He practiced restraint even after he encountered Alarakalama and Udeka Ramaputta by not grasping onto their teachings that he didn't find helpful. He was offered great power to follow those two teachers, and he immediately practiced restraint.
So it's a path. Like Anthony said, it's you start having to wrestle with wrong speech, and you know you're not restraining yourself, and it is a willpower, but then as you keep on the path, it develops into refined mindfulness, and then it just becomes what you are.
Yep. Yeah, what you are is well restrained.
Yeah. The appearance of well restrained. Because it's no longer restrained.
I think about the think about the second noble truth. Craving for and clinging to fabricated views, which manifest in the external world. Craving for and clinging to fabricated views is a problem. Well, how would I stop craving and clinging? How do I stop eating the whole chocolate cake rather than one piece? I have one piece and I practice restraint. That's, so we can't get too caught up on words. And as I started this, I understand that it's a self-referential ego self that doesn't like the word. And that's why it's such a useful word.
That something's busting out and you have to control it.
You do. You do. That's the whole point. But it's not something, it only seems harsh to a mind that's rooted in wrong views. It doesn't want to let go of anything.
Restraint from distraction sounds pleasant. It sounds like paradise.
It is. It's freedom.
It's freedom. Yeah, yeah. It's freedom.
Yep.
It's really freedom.
It's anatta that wants to be deeply entangled in the world and not restrain itself. That's the problem. We kind of got cut you off a little bit.
Oh, I'm done. Right.
Thank you. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning. I don't really think I can add very much to the understanding today. I think it's been very clear. But I will say that when I read the article at home, your teaching has flushed it out, made it, I've got more of the meaning out of it rather than just reading about it. Your teaching today has made the understanding clearer. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. I think we tend to get caught up in wordplay. Early on in studying astronomy, I learned that what happens in history is that people are fine up to a point of what they know, and then when there's the unknown, the salvific element comes in, because it seems that the self, the ego, whatever you want to call it, does not like to have lack of control of what's ahead of them. And so it's easy to call a thunderbolt a strike by God, or something that happens that's unexplainable or horrible, an act of God. And I think restraint is a proper, in my view, and the view that from what I get out of the sutta, a very proper term to restrain from overthinking what was being said in the term of restraint. And that's why I asked you about the control thing, because I find that as I practice my jhana and studies, that when things do happen that I can't control, there is a knee-jerk reaction, almost instinctual, and then you have the restraint, and then that becomes second nature, where it's almost instantaneous through meditation.
Yeah.
And so I'm with you on when I listen to the news or I see things happen in the world, the suffering is from that unrestrained mind and that desire of not to lose control, but we don't have it. You know, we don't have the control. The only thing we can't control, again, if I'm wrong, please let me know, I'm off base here, is that middle way, that eightfold path. Those are the elements, the things that the self, that is me, can't control.
Yep.
Control my right view, and my meditation, and my mindfulness, and my livelihood, and how I react to people. I can control those things. I cannot control a tornado barreling down towards my house.
Yes, that you're exactly right, Tim. When the Buddha's description of stress and suffering describes all the things that we can control. And so he taught that it's suffering because we do cling to those. We want to control it. He says we join with dukkha. Birth, sickness, aging, and death, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. Living life as five clinging aggregates is dukkha. It's all an aspect of grasping after something rather than the restraint, the wise restraint that leads to a calm and peaceful mind. The only thing in the world, when you compare what we can do, what we have actual control over, and the Buddha's description of dukkha that we have no control over, it's simply going to occur as a consequence of human life, we realize that the only thing we can control is our minds. It's the only thing that we can have, if we develop it, we can have control over our minds. And if we gain control over our minds, then we have control over our life, meaning our life experience, how we live our life, which is the most important thing, isn't it? The quality of my mind, moment by moment, is more important than anything else.
And that restraint is the thing we can control.
Yeah, and that restraint then becomes simply a natural consequence of living as an awakened human being. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. I was sitting here looking back on my previous practice where there was an emphasis on abandonment of things that don't work, but restraint was never mentioned. And as a consequence, it didn't work.
Yeah,
it just the stress never really ended because there were still unrestrained minds going around.
Yep, and still are.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at, did I interrupt you?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. The grasping after modern dharmas are just that. They develop. And they're popular because they encourage a lack of restraint. Most of it is geared towards something beyond a human life to begin with. And then if I do all these things right, I'll get a reward somehow. And, you know, and there's all subtle variations of that, but they all encourage a lack of restraint, just like, I won't say who the person is.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've had that direct experience too. And the great freedom that comes from realizing I don't need much more. The Buddha said, human beings, we need food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. He didn't say we should abandon all those things. But he did say we shouldn't be overly consumed with having those things. And when we look at it closely, food, shelter, medicine, and clothing, maybe not medicine, I'm talking in a sense of taking good care of ourselves. they're all rather easily obtained in our human life. It's when we want more than just the basics that we get in trouble and then cling to more than just the basics. So. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. I don't know if I have much to add, but I think that it's very clear with sort of the governing principles, you know, how restraint is sort of the freedom within restraint is tied to right effort. You know, it's like yeah. The quality of your practice is going to show the ease of restraint in your life. I mean, you know, and that's what does the Buddha describe a mind that's calm? I mean, calm and restrained are very, I think they're very similar. You know, yeah. A calm mind is restrained, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty clear.
Yeah, thank you. You can't have one without the other. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I guess the world is filled with religions and groups with rules to restrain behavior.
Yeah.
But if you're not addressing the ignorance, then they're bound to fail, because then it's just willpower, and that's always the muscle that will fail you. But if you're developing that practice, then you're really addressing the root cause, the ignorance. So thank you for the lesson.
Yeah, thank you. I was just reminding you of it. I can't remember this gentleman's name. He was a rather famous atheist, but conceding his what, you know, it was a long discussion about, you know, why religions, blah blah blah. But he said, but there is value in religion in restraining people. And the kind of the implication, and I've heard this argument before, that if we didn't have religion, people would just run amok. They would do all even worse things.
I
don't want to get into the deep discussion of it, but it hasn't worked. But that, again, that's the reason why we see the need. We may see the need for religion to apply restraint where human beings can't naturally restrain themselves. But again, that's a lack of control, isn't it?
But that might be called wrong restraint.
Yeah, I would say it is.
What purpose is?
Yeah. I was told that I was born with something called original sin. I was bad just for, really, I mean, that's literally how it's thought. But it's such a good way, it's such a good way to control people, isn't it? I mean, you're immediately stuck under the thumb of something you have no understanding of. And you're encouraged to believe it out of fear. Where there's desire, there's fear. Where there's fear, there's stress. I had a lot of stress. And I had even to come to grips with that. I mean, I can feel it in my body right now, 12, 13 years old. Trying to figure out, what did I do wrong?
Well, what's that metaphor, the pole and the horse being restrained, and it's just pulling and pulling, because it probably doesn't understand why it's being restrained.
Yeah.
If you understand why you're in this practice to develop restraint, and then you're not pulling against that.
Yep. Yeah, there's another great story in the Dhamma where the Buddha uses an elephant. And teaching it, taming a wild elephant, likening that to training our minds, to calming our mind down. And I don't want to tell the whole story, but we're learning to restrain ourselves. In that story, we restrain the elephant with a strong rope to a post, and eventually the elephant calms down. We practice restraint in our minds through jhana practice, and we can take that off our cushion.
That's how they train falcons too.
That's right.
They put a hood on the falcon so it can't even
restrain it.
It can't even have contact with the world through its eyes, so it's calm.
Of course,
the hood for every day until the bird's calm.
Yes, that's a good. It's not really a metaphor. It's a good example. If we to domesticate animals so they're helpful towards us, we have to restrain them. This is the same thing. Morning, Brett.
Morning. thanks for the teaching. It's something I actually understand pretty well. you have to have if you have wrong views of yourself, you have to stop yourself and restrain your mind so you don't, go down the rabbit hole of, having these wrong views and continuing like agitated mind. So it's like this is basic concept of the Dharma.
Yeah.
Coming back to your breath and abandoning wrong views, and you have to have a restrained mind to do that, or you're just gonna go crazy. And then as you
stay crazy.
Stay crazy, yeah. And as you're saying something like, about the Lamborghini or something like that, at that moment I'm thinking about this workshop for sale that's up the road, and how I can dive into that whole thing, and it's the whole thing that's not very good at doing. So it's restraining your mind, and so I can apply this really commonly in my life. And if you feel a certain way, and you have emotions that come up, and then you want to automatically reach out and do something with those emotions, and you have to have a restrained mind to come back and abandon you know, or, you know, look at your mind, look at your emotions, and come back to your breath, and, you know, and practice life as life as unfolding. So.
Yeah. That's it. Thank you. As life unfolds, it's like, as the Buddha teaches here, it's the key or the foundation of happiness.
Yeah.
Morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you for the teaching. It really does touch on every aspect of the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
And it really, one thing that touches in me is right effort. Sometimes right effort can be a huge struggle. You know, you're meditating and trying to restrain your mind and trying to restrain your thoughts or let them go. But sometimes right effort, to me, it's like, I'm not doing the right effort. I'm not attaining what I need to be attaining. But then you really have to realize you have to almost let go.
Yeah.
And once you can let go, it's just, it's easier that way.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that, Kevin. You bring up such an important point there, too, in meditation. Right effort in meditation is simply engaging in the method, meaning that when you find that you're caught up in your thinking, it doesn't mean that you're now engaged in wrong effort, as long as you come back to the sensation of breathing. And it doesn't matter, right effort isn't defined by how many times you have to do it or not do it. Right effort as it relates to meditation is meditation. If you're doing it, you're engaged in right effort. But our minds will say, oh, I can only be mindful of my breath for 2 seconds and I'm back up in my thought. All of that is, if you engage in it, is wrong effort. You're allowing your mind to distract yourself rather than deepen concentration. But if you find yourself in a 20-minute meditation that after 18 minutes you realize you've been thinking about tomorrow's Ferrari, and you come back to your breath for the last 2 minutes intermittently, that's right effort. It's not quantitative. It's just the practice. It's the sitting practice. It couldn't be more simpler, and it couldn't be more impersonal than the Buddha instructs. But we get caught up in our thoughts even in that way, don't we? You know?
And even there, it's restraint at the point of contact.
Whenever it comes up. And then, you know, that's another point about wise restraint. No matter how far gone we are in our thinking or our actions, even if we're at the 9th piece of cake of 10, we can stop there. It's not too late to practice restraint. And that's so important because our minds will say, what the hell? I've already had 9. Let me have 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we all do that at times, don't we? Mm-hmm. And it's that fabricated thought that is the essence of the Dhamma. I've already had a lot. Let me have a little bit more. It's a self-referential ego self insisting that it cannot be restrained even after 9 pieces of chocolate cake. Good to see you, Nick. Thank you, Kevin.
Restraint is something that I need to practice, that I really, 2 things going on. One is clinging to past mistakes. If I could set them aside, and the way to do it, and if I could figure out a way of doing it, but if I'm not thinking about them, then there I have triggers. Then the trigger, the outside influence, something happens, my wife says something, or that trigger creates so restraint has to be not only restraining from the outside influence, but also restraining my mind from dwelling in the past.
Yes, and that's exactly how we do it. You've been coming about 6 months, is that right? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, and if you don't feel like answering, just say so, and it's, you know, I don't take it personal. But I would bet that you have developed a noticeable measure of restraint, even in that situation that you're talking about, that we've discussed in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that has helped the situation, and that, well, from what you're saying, it's still there, though.
Yes. Because of who I am, then I start beating myself up because I'm not doing a good enough job at restraining myself from
what Kevin was talking about.
Yeah.
But even there, you're increasing your restraint at that point of contact, meaning when it's arising. when your thoughts are going back to what you did and why you all that, you're able to practice restraint now. Mm-hmm. And as you continue that practice of restraint at that point of contact, when it's arising in your mind, eventually you'll get to the point where you will abandon it. And you're simply training yourself, your own mind, to stop further conditioning along those lines at that point. So first we're deconditioning our minds, if you will, and eventually we let it go. Thank you. Michael, I saw your hand up and I just thought we'd get down to you. So
yeah,
I wasn't ignoring you.
Yeah, I'm good with that. The restraint is necessary for if we didn't have restraint or we didn't exercise restraints, then, or there was, it wasn't necessary, so to say, then we would, and we, again, we'd be all Buddhists, wouldn't we, if we didn't actually have to subscribe to restraint.
You mean if it simply wasn't a necessary part of being a human being?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. But again, you bring up another good point. It's not just hoping or wishing or dabbling around in this. You know, it's not having faith. It's actually doing it.
It's actually something that, you know, that to evolve to that point, we have to cultivate and integrate the Eightfold Path.
Yes. While you're talking, I don't know why this triggered this thought to me, but I was taught that to get my reward, I could get my reward if I practiced these, if I didn't break these Ten Commandments. And so that's an external restraint imposed on me. But the underlying motivation was not to simply, not to have a common, peaceful, and meaningful human life. What it did was distract me towards, okay, I'm going to do this grudgingly because I'll get a reward for it. I'll get something for it. I'll be able to acquire something by doing these things rather than simply practicing restraint to develop a calm and peaceful mind. There's no acquisition there, is there? It's just simple and profound instruction on how to be a human being. Recognizing, again, I remember the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, meaning from, he understood that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. So we're practicing restraint at the manifestation of ignorance in this moment. And the same situation from a mind rooted in ignorance or a mind awakened looks the same from the outside. And even internally, it might feel the same, except there won't be any reaction. Meaning when it's appropriate for me to be sad as an awakened human being, I'm sad, but I don't need it to be any different. And the sadness doesn't arise from something needing to be different. It's simply an appropriate feeling for what's occurring. The Buddha felt a lot of sadness during his lifetime, and he responded to it in an incredibly meaningful way. He helped people along. Good morning, Julia. Thank you, Michael.
Thinking about that word restraint again, I understand like the difference. You know, like one is outside restraint, you know, by broken systems that we see all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the negative connotation of that word. But the inner restraint is self-imposed, and it helps us to actually to peace. And so that's the difference of that word. Because I started to realize, I said, no, it's because I'm always looking at the word restraint as government restraining, you know, religion restraining, education restraining, trying to like force people to be certain things, and that's the negative version of the word. But an inner restraint is brings peace, because it takes away all the distractions and makes us be, you know, ourselves.
Yeah.
So the big difference.
It's a huge difference, and that subtle difference that you see is so important.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to see, isn't it? Especially at first.
And you hear the word, you're like...
the restraint that societal systems try to impose on us,
mm-hmm,
are because people are unrestrained.
Right.
And as a society, as a country, as a town, as whatever it might be, as a United Nations, we feel we need to impose restraint, not offer people to take it up.
Right.
We need to legislate. And really what we're doing is legislating against this basic ignorance. Of course, that's not how it's seen, but that's what the Buddha saw too. So we can't, we're never going to legislate away any of the things we're trying to. It just won't work because there's an underlying ignorance.
But the best way to control all that outside is by the inner restraint. If you have a society of inner beings who are inner restrained, outside will be the same.
Yes.
The outside world will actually reflect peace. The rest of the community, you know, would be, they're beings of peace now. And no need to restrain them anymore.
Yes.
They're restrained.
That is the most important aspect today of what Buddhism can bring. You often hear me say the most loving thing I can do for myself and all other sentient beings, all other human beings, is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. There's not one other thing that I could do that would have more of a profound effect on peace and prosperity in the world than that one thing. So some people will say, well, nobody else is going to do it, or so few people will do it. That's a grasping view, isn't it? That's saying, I'm not going to develop calm and peaceful mind. I'm not going to develop the Dhamma because they won't. By the way, that's an underlying reason for the Bodhisattva idea that the Buddha said when I was an unawakened Bodhisattva, that there's nothing valuable in making that a path. I'm just making that as a commentary. But because of that, there's no restraint in it. It's much like what Ram was describing too. But you saw such a subtle aspect of it. There's societal, maybe the best word is institutionalized restraint, which doesn't work and it's always stressful. Well, I shouldn't say it doesn't work. We need some legislative restraint because people can't restrain themselves. But as a way of developing peace and calm, it's antithetical to that. We can only do that ourselves. So thank you for seeing that in Sierra.
Thank you, John.
Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. I don't think I have too much to add, but just, you know, you said we're all at different levels of understanding of this, and I'm like pretty much right at the beginning. But I just, you know, I have an unrestrained mind, and it definitely causes suffering. Mm-hmm. So I see what the Buddha's talking about there. And I guess just recognizing it at this point and trying to do the meditation and stuff is all I can do for right now.
It is. Thank you. But I think you see how this will work in helping you to restrain your mind and abandon some of those things that you're dealing with right now. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is that simple and that direct. We learn how to control our minds. In the Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha says we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. Think about that. I'll no longer be controlled by my thoughts. I can control my thoughts. And each and every moment of my life then, whatever I'm thinking and whatever I'm feeling is entirely appropriate to what's occurring. There's no me in it. There's no stress in it. There's no distraction. There's no fabrication. There's no imagination. It's simply what's occurring. And I understand it. And I don't take it personal because nothing's personal. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. Thank you for a great class today. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. There was something else I wanted to say, but I can't think of what it was. Our retreat's coming up, I think, in 3 weeks. Please come. That's all I can say. And if you haven't been on a retreat, there's no way to... Those that have been on retreat, there's no way to describe how much Dhamma you can integrate in that setting of 3.5 days of talks and meditation. And so I hope you join us. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. And these are the words of the Buddha from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety,
may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.